We're the ones with the aircraft, the traps, and the guns. And the wolves are the ones that have to kill to stay alive or scavenge. So if we kill wolves, that means more game for us, right? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The work of biologist Gordon Haber shows that killing wolves can do the opposite of what you might think. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, statewide and toll-free. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. What we can learn from wolves is the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Photographer Brian Adams, with the opening of his exhibit and the release of his new book, I Am Alaskan, An Exploration of Identity, at the Alaska Native Arts Foundation, 5 p.m. Friday, November 1st.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, we know this is kind of a volatile subject, and I expect quite a few people who want to comment and participate. And I want to remind you, if you do use the talk@alaskapublic.org way of getting an email to me, try and keep it a little bit on the short side, because it's hard for me to like read them and also maintain the conversation at the same time. So with that, I think we'll begin the show. And the topic is the wolf. The wolf may have been our companion. Well, certainly was our companion into prehistory. And the wolf research of Gordon Haber has been put into a book along with some amazing and compelling photographs, aerial mostly, by Mary Beth Holloman. So the book by Gordon Haber, the late Gordon Haber, and Mary Beth Holloman, Among Wolves. Gordon Haber's insights into Alaska's most misunderstood animal. Mary Beth, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I got pre-publication on this, right? This isn't quite out yet?
It's out now. Okay. Some people are getting it, yes.
Good. And are you pleased with it?
I am pleased, yes. I mean, it was an interesting process, co-authoring a book with someone who's not here anymore. And the University of Alaska Press did a great job with the publication and the design and everything.
And you, his plane went down in 2009, right?
Right, October 2009, yep.
At one point, did you think this might be worth making a book out of?
Well, it was such a shock when he died, and no one expected it. We helped to organize a memorial for him here in Anchorage, and I met and talked to his former pilot, Troy Dunn, and Johnny Johnson, his good friend since the 60s, and a lot of the people that he knew, and we all felt such a loss that all the work he'd done was just going to disappear with his death, because he never wrote a book himself. He certainly published a lot of articles and such, but to compile it all. So the original idea was that I thought that we could all do it together, at like a community, just like a community of wolves. You know, Johnny Johnson's a photographer. He could take care of that. But as it turned out, it all fell to me.
So, let's all form a committee.
Exactly. I should know better.
Guess who does the work? Let's fill in a little historic. Before we get to what I'm sure will be controversial and probably amazing, I can't imagine a person that wouldn't be amazed by some of the findings that Gordon has in this book, but also controversial. Maybe we should just do a little historical background. Because I know, reading the history of Denali National Park, the reason that the park, along with the incredible geographic features that it contains, one of the reasons the park was created and preserved so early was because they were worried that the sheep might be killed to extinction by market hunters, people that were feeding railroad construction crews and such like that. And So it was a great big game place, and so they preserved it for that reason. But what also happened before very long was that Adolf Muri decided to watch those wolves in a protected area, a place where the policy in Alaska was basically wolves are after the same meat that we're after, and so we need to pretty much wipe them out. Jay Hammond was among many who gunned wolves from the air. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go to the museum in Talkeetna last time I was there and see Don Sheldon's rigged guns that he had on the wings of his plane to kill to kill wolves.
Yeah. Everyone was doing it then. Mm-hmm.
Everyone was doing it, and it was Muri's work really, which started to give the public some insight and biologists into what was really going on with these, what were predators, yes, but beyond predators.
Right. The predator-prey interactions and the way that wolves actually help prey populations and are such an integral part of the whole ecosystem that you can't have a healthy ecosystem without them, just like we've learned with the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone and how that's affected the diversity of that place.
And that's fairly inarguable, I think, at this point.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had Donald Cameron on, I think, at one point, explaining that there's really no argument that it enriched. You return the top predator and it enriches the ecosystem, or it tends to.
Right, it does. And that's, what Muri was doing and what Gordon wanted to continue Muri's work was to study a family group of wolves that were not exploited, that were not hunted or trapped or in any way killed by humans, so that we could see how they are in that kind of natural system versus how they are in the exploited areas, which is basically the rest of the country.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. I don't think anybody's talking about wolves in Alaska becoming extinct in any meaningful period of time, although I suppose it's possible to contemplate such a thing because it has happened in vast pieces of geography already.
Yes, it has. In fact, the Board of Game wanted Department of Fish and Game to do some wolf predator control north of Denali last year, and they said, well, they couldn't find any wolves.
Hmm.
So...
Well, speaking of that, to cut to the end of the book, the part that you added after Gordon's death with the new numbers from the park,
right?
The wolves of Denali are not in as healthy a condition as they were in Muri's day or really in any day that anybody can remember.
That's right.
And the chance of seeing a wolf in the park has gone down.
Yes, it has. The chance of seeing a wolf in the park has dropped by 70% since 2010.
Yeah, that just blows my mind.
70%. So these visitors, hundreds of thousands of people that come every summer, spend all this money in Alaska, as tourists. They come to the park, they want to see bears, they want to see moose, they want to see sheep, and they want to see wolves. And if they see a wolf, that is the height of their trip. And to have that decrease by 70% in 3 years is unconscionable, really.
Mary Beth Holloman, co-author of Among Wolves, Gordon Haber's Insights into Alaska's Most Misunderstood Animal, is our guest. And Mary Beth, I have to say, two visits back, maybe three visits back to the park. I love the park. I go there every chance I get. I was maybe Teklanika, and there was a wolf right there, right walking by us.
Yeah.
And ignoring us.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it's acting like a dog. Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of problem here? And there's Gordon had some excellent insights on this, mm-hmm. that actually when you look at where would a wolf walk, mm-hmm. where was the tradition for the wolf to be, one of the ways the road itself was located was old game trails.
Right, of course. A lot of our roads and trails are that way. And, even some of the thousand-year-old den sites were previously occupied by humans in prehistoric times. So, yeah, we share a lot in common in terms of how we move through the landscape. And Gordon also pointed out, and there's a whole chapter in the book on it, that this is when you see wolves in the park acting unconcerned about the presence of humans in cars and buses, it's not that they've become habituated or somehow more tame, but it's actually that they've become, that's more their natural behavior, that the fear that they demonstrate to humans in the rest of the state, where they run at the first chance of seeing us, is actually adapted because of all the hunting and trapping, because they see us as a real threat. But that in their natural behavior, they are top predators, you know, and their natural behavior to humans is one of unconcern. And he recorded many times where hikers and campers would come upon wolves, and the wolves would simply just make a wide arc around them and keep going. You know, they just really just were unconcerned with their presence, and they certainly didn't try to attack or in any way harm them.
Well, people do have stories about wolves gathering around them.
Yes.
they felt threatened.
Right. Well, Gordon has a great story in there about he's camping near one of the den sites in summer, and he's awakened at 5 a.m. in the morning by this huffing sound, and the wolves had circled his tent. And they'd been coming back from a night's hunt, and, you know, there was this strange thing very close to their natal den where their pups were. But all they did is they kind of made some noise and huffed, and then they just went on back home, and they, you know, they left him alone, but they were obviously not pleased with him being so close. Yeah, you know, territory. I mean, that's certainly part of it.
Yeah, he has tales about the places where he would, you know, because he would camp for as long as he could to get observation time in. And, of course, you're going to have to pee when that happens.
Yeah.
And he would come back and find that his spots had all been remarked.
That's right. Again and again, he and the wolves would remark the spot.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
Well, what I thought I was going to get with this book, Mary Beth, and what I did get are two very different things. First off, I was unprepared for the photographs. They're utterly compelling. I mean, I can't even imagine. You're doing a slideshow with this later on, right?
I am. October 20th at the LUSAC, the Wilda Marston Theater, Sunday afternoon.
I would love to see some of these bigger, you know, because sometimes you're just looking at dots, basically.
Right.
And then you have to follow the narrative and say, well, what's happening here is you can see the dark ones in front, and that's the mother. And when But he knew these animals. And what we have here is it's mostly his writing. It's just you've like curated or arranged it. And it's some things he wrote as articles, some things he wrote as a book that he might finish someday that he never did.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's a little comments prepared for the game board.
Right.
and you just sort of put it all together.
Right.
But he had actually he's presenting his own case here.
Oh, he certainly is. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I went back through all his papers starting in the mid-60s. And so some of this comes from articles he wrote in the 70s and papers that he wrote, a paper that he wrote on endangered species for a conference, you know, something like that, up to the present, his research reports to his funders, all of that.
And he couldn't wait. I mean, he couldn't wait to get to Alaska and get to wolves.
That's right.
From the very beginning.
Right. Yeah,
biologist, this is what he wanted to do.
This is what he wanted to do. I found his family gave me some of his materials from when he was a kid, and I found a paper he wrote when he was a senior in high school saying, if there's one thing I am determined, that is to spend most of my life in the out of doors. And I think that's pretty cool to know that part of yourself so well and to follow it so strongly. He came to Alaska as soon as he could, and you know, he just never left.
Did he came from some place in the Midwest that I thought might even actually be Red Wolf country?
Well, he grew up in Detroit, but he did undergraduate work and some graduate work in Isle Royale. So he did see wolf-moose interactions from that very classic place. So.
And then when he got to Alaska, to the national park, were what, in the 60s?
66.
Mm-hmm. And he essentially just picks right up on Murie's research with the same pack.
Oh, he does. He
can't. But he doesn't call it pack. He calls it family. And this is, we'll get to this. You know, it's very important. He says tradition, and he says family, not pack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can tell me, but it seems like he thought PAC just had the wrong implication.
Right. I mean, he was smart. He realized language is important. And we know that as a culture. The language that we use connotes certain things. And PAC has certain connotations for the way we have mythologized wolves and the way we have feared them as some kind of group of snarling beasts intent on killing whatever they see.
And they'll form these gangs at random.
A bunch of hoodlums running around causing trouble. And so he, at some point in his career, decided, I'm not going to use that word anymore. I think we should call them family groups, because that's what they are. They're groups of extended family members. And they're almost all related. And so it's this lineage that continues. And the Toklat, which the Park Service calls East Fork, so it's a little confusing, but they're the family group that Murie first studied in the 20s. And Haber continued that. In fact, Murie was still around in the park when Haber first came, and he, you know, firsthand information from the man himself, and said, yes, those are the same wolves. That's the same wolf family. So the idea that you could study one family group, there's really only one other in the world that we know of that's been studied so continuously, and that's Jane Goodall's chimpanzees. Those are the only two social groups that were continuously studied for such a period of time.
So he never, rarely speculates on a state of mind of a wolf, what's going through their head. He's mostly in wonderment.
Right.
But he is observing qualities of memory and qualities of understanding the particularities of terrain. And strategies of hunting that only one family has. And when that family loses its cohesion, that strategy of hunting no longer exists.
That's right.
Unless it's extinct. Unless some individual reinvents it or something.
Right. Basically, it's an extinction of different traditions of the family group. One very clear example, when he first came to the park, the first group of wolves he saw were the Savage River wolves. There's a great story in there about the guy who helped find them, Gary Baker. And so the Savage River and Toklats were the two main groups he studied. The Savage River wolves disappeared entirely in the winter of 82-83, most likely from illegal hunting. But they had a particular way of hunting moose, which Gordon never saw another family group ever do in his whole 43 years, was something he named Storm and Circle, and there are photos of it in the book. A particular technique where they run straight at the moose and then they circle it, and then it's like they figure out, is this moose, you know, worth us trying to kill? And most of the time, they leave. In fact, according to Gordon's research, only about 5% of the time that wolves come across a moose in winter do they even try to attack. Only 5% of the time. When they do, they're usually successful. But that's because they're so good at figuring out whether this is possible, whether this moose is old and weak or has an inexperienced mother, something like that.
And a cow is very capable of protecting one calf and even a pair.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. There's a series of photos in here that shows exactly that, a cow protecting two calves.
Which is sort of mind-blowing.
Yeah. Well, they're big. Moose are so much bigger than wolves, and they can kill them so quickly with one swift kick, and the wolves know that. I mean, I can't imagine us as humans attacking a wolf with our hands and teeth.
And his observations also go into how the younger wolves, they become physically mature fairly quickly and even sexually mature fairly quickly.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they're going to breed.
Right.
And that doesn't mean they're all that smart. And essentially, they are disciplined for an extended period of time within the family. When mm-hmm. I say disciplined, I mean they wouldn't be allowed to put themselves at risk with that moose.
Right, right, right.
That blows my mind.
Yeah, he recorded four phases that pups go through before they become proficient hunters, and it takes 2 to 3 years for them to reach that, and especially with wolves that are hunting huge, dangerous animals like moose or sheep, they're, you know, it's very dangerous terrain that they're covering. So the pups could get themselves in serious trouble.
And the other thing that I really envy his having been able to see was when they go after sheep, the kind of terrain that they can tackle with the kind of physical prowess. You see that in bears. You know, you see bears do things physically that are take your breath away for years.
Right.
But these wolves going up these 60-degree slopes and things like that.
Right. Going up them and then skiing back down them. I mean, he's seen wolves come flying up a hill, and it's like they don't even look where they're going. All of a sudden, they go over a cliff, and they ski stiff-legged down the slope. He said, like, faster than any Olympic skier he's ever seen. Yeah, they're pretty. Their athleticism is astonishing, and they're, and for a all of their senses are amazing. For example, he recorded that in winter, most of their food comes from scavenging, up to 85%. They can dig 10 feet down to find a moose carcass. That means they can smell that carcass in winter, 10 feet under the snow.
Yes, and that changes the whole equation of what we think of as predation, and always you've got to bring down an animal. But actually, while they can consume rather a family of wolves, I'm trying not to say pack.
Thank you. I know, it takes some training.
Yeah, you know, can really put that meat away pretty fast. Mm-hmm. But there are also those that animals that die in the winter.
Right.
To be scavenged.
Right.
And more than half of their diet is that.
Yes. And one of the myths about wolves is that they don't eat everything, that, you know, trappers and hunters have come across a half-eaten moose. And he said, well, what that's about is that when they come upon a moose that's frozen and dead in the middle of winter, well, it's frozen and they can't eat it all at once because it's not thawed out. The guts are usually the last to freeze. So they eat that first, but then they'll keep coming back unless a human comes along and disturbs them. And then, so it's a misperception there. They eat everything. I mean, there's a picture in the book of the remains of a 200-pound ram, and it's just the horns and a little bit of the skull. And he watched the wolves eat that ram in 12 minutes.
So that's worse than piranhas.
They're efficient. They are very efficient.
All right. Well, one more thing before we start with the calls and the phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A call from Anchorage would just be a direct call at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. And also, we have people who are listening in on President Obama's address, addressing the nation with whatever he's addressing them about, and will let me know when and how and what actually he said. So you're not missing it by listening to the radio here in this fascinating discussion of these beings. So you have a situation where the young actually spend a significant, kind of like human beings, spend a significant portion of their lifespan, actually longer than a human would, mm-hmm. just getting to be a full adult.
Yes, about 25% of their lifespan.
That's amazing.
So a quarter of their lifespan is spent learning, spent basically as children learning. They learn the territory, they learn the hunting techniques, they learn where the den sites are. Wolves use different den sites depending on what's going on with prey populations. There's all kinds of things that they need to learn. And so for example, the Toklats suffered a series of tragic losses between 2001 and 2005, which Gordon recorded in detail. And do you mind if I go into that story? Is that okay?
Why don't you go ahead? Yeah.
Okay. So it was the most efficient, closely bonded pair that Gordon observed in his 43 years in Denali. And in 2001, the alpha male was killed in a botched darting study by the federal government. And then the female, who was pregnant with pups, she still stayed with the group, but two males appeared to the group, and they were actually, because Gordon has also studied wolves, in the 40-mile area in Yukon Charlie, were wolves from that area that the state had relocated. And then these two males traveled 200 miles to get to come to Denali and just happened to come upon this group at the very time they didn't have a leader. And they assumed leadership. They raised the pups of this dead male that year, which shows a lot of reciprocity. They weren't their genes, but they still raised them. But then the female ended up leaving the group, from losing her mate, and she ended up dying alone and starving because the bonds, they're monogamous wolves, and so their bonds are so strong that they just sometimes don't withstand the loss. And so then the new alpha pair had pups and had a few good years, but then she was trapped on the boundary of the park, and the male spent months after her death in January going back and forth between the snare site and the den site, bringing all the other wolves with him so that several more wolves were lost to those snares because that kept going back to the snare site. He kept looking for her, basically. I mean, Gordon observed him sitting and howling and searching for her. And then finally he was shot by a hunter on the outside of the park because he kept going outside the park to try to find her. That left only 6 1- and 2-year-olds, no experienced adult wolves in the Toklat pack. So what happened, So what happened is they didn't know their territory. Their territory shrunk. They lost a lot of it. And they didn't know how to hunt sheep. The incredible sheep hunting disappeared. Fortunately, they probably would have died, except the hare population was really high. So they were eating rabbits the whole time. They ate snowshoe hare for years.
What a weird awakening to all of a sudden there aren't any snowshoe hares anymore.
And right.
It's been really tough for them.
Yes, yes. And Gordon knew that was just a short-term solution. But essentially, the family group just, you know, they just fall apart when an alpha is taken. And it's very different than the deaths from natural causes. When wolves are taken from natural causes, it's usually the young, inexperienced wolves that disperse or get in trouble, not the alphas.
But two things I think are key. One is that it doesn't stop them reproducing. There's still gonna be more pups.
Sure.
There's gonna be more wolves. They're just gonna be not as smart wolves.
They're not going to know the traditions of the territory or the prey. They're more likely to just find an easy meal wherever they can find it, which, you know, yes, might include some dogs.
Yeah.
I really think that that's the problem, is that Gordon was saying, you know, if we leave them alone, if we let them have an intact family group for generations and generations, they're so beautifully tuned to their environment that they will regulate their own populations and they will keep the ecosystem healthy. But when we go in and shoot them up and scatter them, a bunch more matings will occur. We could even end up with more wolves. And if they're gone, someone else is going to fill the niche anyhow. I mean, the wolves harassed the bears in Denali, so he was feeling like they kept the bears from predating on moose calves as much in places. So
there could just be a simple displacement
Exactly.
Just get more bear predation if you have less wolf predation.
Right. Okay. Of course, the Board of Game says, well, we'll just get rid of bears too.
Yeah, they did, didn't they?
They did do that.
But you can't do that inside of a national park. But the problem was that it turned out that the boundaries are different than the park boundaries. And so there are these areas that are not that hard to learn. And the other thing that's very important is, in terms of predator control, it's going to be the alphas who are the most likely to be killed in predator control incidents, and even in trapping.
Yes, because they're the leaders. They're leading the pack. They're in the front of the line. They lead in the hunts, and they lead in all the traveling that they do. And so they're the ones that are going to be most likely trapped and shot. And that's been proven time and again. And not just in Denali. That same thing happened to some of the Yellowstone family groups, the Cottonwood and the Lamar. It was the alphas that were taken. And the result is that the entire family group disintegrated, scattered, disappeared. And, you know, it's just a shame that we can't have some places in the country where intact wolf family groups can be afforded full protection.
Well, and it could be argued that Denali should have been that place.
Yes, Denali should be that place. And unfortunately, we've got this little segment of area called the Stampede Trail or the Wolf Townships. And that's part of their territory, and that's where the caribou go in winter, so that's where the wolves go too, and that's where the trap lines and the hunters are. It's just such, it's amazingly ridiculous that we cannot have a buffer there to protect them or some way of protecting them when it's so clear. There's a map there with National Park Service and Gordon Haber's data points showing the wolf's locations, and it's so obvious that that area is part of their regular territory.
You know, when I think about that piece of geography, I mean, when I first arrived in Alaska and started scrutinizing my map, I looked at, why is that notch in that park? Why is that big old? And then I saw, well, it's because there used to be a road there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then I started getting fixated on this little piece of geography. I learned that the berry picking there is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that the wolf howling is phenomenal. I learned that Chris McCandless went there and died.
Right.
That everybody knew about.
Yes.
this for whatever the reasons are, you know, old roadways or whatever, this is not part of the park. And it's geographically and biologically seems like it ought to be, but it ain't.
Sure. It's a strange little chunk that's out of it. And the other thing to remember, too, is that we're only talking about two trappers that are having this huge impact on Denali National Park wolves. We're not talking about a lot of people that are taking wolves. It's just two guys.
Well, I think we'll take the calls and take the break first, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
Alaska's most misunderstood animal. Among wolves, Gordon Haber's insights into Alaska's most misunderstood animal. The subject of our show, co-author Mary Beth Holloman is with us. Mary Beth, is that your choice of words, most misunderstood?
Oh, that was in with the acquisitions editor at the press. We came up with the subtitle. But the title is mine, Among Wolves.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about that most misunderstood because we do seem to have a lot of misunderstanding.
We do. There's a lot of mythology about wolves. And, you know, I was thinking that we have a mythology about these top predators like wolves and bears and sharks. And the more that science learns about them, the more we learn about how they actually are, the less we fear them. There's that, you know, we fear what we don't know. And I think wolves are one of those predators that the more we learn about them, the more we realize there's really not much to fear here. And there's actually very much to be incredibly curious and full of wonder about and much to delight in.
Well, the guy whose name escapes me who did all the bonobo research, I went to a lecture that he gave, and you'd think I'd remember his name, but he theorized that that there's something in ourselves that feeds this type of mythology that we have built, that that we picture ourselves as humans that there's a veneer of civilization, and then inside is our animal nature, and we're afraid of the animal nature, not realizing that that's now the way things are built.
Right.
That's not the way things are biologically for any kind of animal, including the human animal.
Right. And the more we fear our animal nature, the more it comes out in very distorted and strange and violent and awful ways.
A form of projection.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, John joins the program from Sterling. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having this wonderful program. Also, a lot of insight I've already been subject to so far. Thank you so much.
Wow, that was quick. Thanks a lot, John, for your call, and thanks for holding on for that. Now, just next door to Saldatna, and Bob. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Good morning, Steve. What you said about the human thing, you know, it probably goes back to our primal days when we would huddle around a fire, fearing the animals in the dark and waiting for the sun to come up. My favorite shirt, I bought it some years ago, the T-shirt. I think the artist's name is Holt, H-O-L-T. It's very good graphic on the front of it. It has two wolves and a super cub, flying the super cub. One of them has a gun in his hand and sunglasses, and it says, "Stop aerial wolf hunting now." You know, I think we should be very blessed that wolves don't fly super cubs and carry guns.
I have that same photo, actually. I have a print of it.
I'd like to get a print of that. I, you know, well, this T-shirt I've had for many years, and I cherish it, and I haven't seen another one in a long time. But
yeah.
Maybe I'll just clean it and have it hermetically sealed in between something and hang it that way. But
yeah, you got to reserve it for special occasions, or it'll just get full of holes.
Yeah. I've always liked this. I've had various comments on it, mostly good.
Mostly good.
Some will look at it and say, "Oh, you're one of those," you know.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Have a good day. Well, I enjoy your show. Thank you, Steve.
Hey. Okay, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for your call. Nice. Getting dittos here. A call from also on the Kenai Peninsula, and probably should bring up that predator control is an issue right now for the Kenai Peninsula that I don't know if you want to bring that up or not, but it is definitely an issue there. A woman from Kenai called to say that on Saturday it is Wolf Day at the zoo. So she's coming up to Anchorage with the kids because it's going to be Wolf Day at the zoo. And Mary Beth has a reading coming up and slideshow coming up at the Lusac Library in Anchorage on the 20th, I believe.
On the 20th at 3:30 in the afternoon.
And we'll probably want you to get a reading ready here pretty quick. But let's go ahead and talk to Charlie down in Homer first. Charlie, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mary Beth Holloman.
Thank you, and good morning, Steve.
Morning.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
I'm really from the Pacific Northwest. I've been gone from there for 40 years, but the policies, the reason why the wolf policies, I think, or the wolf myths, the same thing with the brown bear, the grizzly bear, the myths of the grizzly bear, have been developed by the ranchers who are renting, I guess is a way to describe it, national forest and national BLM lands to graze their cattle on for pennies per acre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an economic thing. They've got all this free grazing as long as, you know, wolves will probably eat cows just as well as they'll eat sheep or moose. And so will the bear. And so the big thing down there, and they've done it time and time again, is they kill all the wolves out. They kill all the alpha males and females out, and the pack, the family units disappear. And I don't know. We've got a problem. We people have a problem. Thank you for a wonderful show, and I'll listen off the air.
All right, Charlie. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Charlie. And yeah.
It is really a work in progress down there in the lower 48 on that. But go ahead.
Can I make one point? Yeah, Charlie, thank you so much for bringing that up. I think that Gordon's research has a lot to add to this conversation about delisting the gray wolf in the lower 48, and I'd really like to get it heard down there because they really are missing the point. The federal government is thinking of delisting the wolves based on numbers alone, but you just take a look at Gordon's research and you find that you're not supposed to manage wolves by numbers. You need to manage them by their functional characteristic, their functional unit, which is the family group. And so the whole discussion about delisting them is just misses the mark, and it's such a travesty. And I think you're right on about the ranchers too. That's an interesting subsidy that we, the taxpayers, are paying for. And it's a shame that they can't learn to just deal with the fact that there are going to be wolves that are recolonizing those areas.
I have enjoyed the work of Bernd Heinrich for years, the raven researcher. And he calls them the wolf bird. And it is his theory that there's a deep and very ancient relationship between humans and ravens and humans and wolves. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They were... really have many more directions in our evolution and the way that we relate to our environment that are in common than separate.
Yes. And that's an interesting aspect of our fear and hatred of wolves. It's almost like we are fearing, like you said, it's like we fear and hate a part of ourselves. And or we fear and hate an animal that is maybe better at hunting than we are, even with our snow machines and our guns and our airplanes.
Well, there's this, in terms of the science of biology, it would seem that enlightened management would want to have those buffers, and that it almost takes a quality of denial to try and argue on, like, numbers alone and those type of arguments.
Right.
It just seems to me that you can't, you know, if you want to follow, here was this Toklat family, you know, wiped out,
mm-hmm.
you know, had been continuously observed for all these many years.
70 years.
And, you know, we're getting all this fragmentation to the point where the chances of seeing a wolf for a visitor to Denali Park is down to, what did you say?
5%?
12%. When it was up around 50.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was up around 60-some percent, and now it's down to 12%. And it's because we've shot up these wolf family groups. We've let them get trapped and hunted out. But also
losing the ability to make the observations.
Exactly. You know, there's this loss to science, and there's this loss to our understanding of our place in the world and the creatures that we share it with. I mean, Gordon really felt that there was so much that the learning about wolves could teach us about ourselves because of the similarities in the species. We're also predators.
And as you have noted, he felt that there were some hunting patterns and things like that have simply gone extinct because they never got passed on.
That's right. He also...
That's extinct.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He also talked, too, about, you know, the wolf family groups he observed, they had 4 or 5 generations of continuity. And he said, what was it like? What would it be like if they had 10 or 15 generations of continuity? What incredible adaptations could we see in wolf family groups if we would let them alone for that long? And you know, he would say again and again that we're the ones that are losing out when we do this, because we're losing out on a very part of what makes us human, and that is that sense of wonder for the incredible complexity of the world around us and the animals that we share the world with.
Well, John and Sterling is back on the line because he got so busy patting us on the back, he forgot to get his point across. John, welcome back to Talk Alaska.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah. I really did have a question following up on that. Thank you, I gave you. And the basic question is this. Do you think that not having Gordon Haber there to testify relative to science before the Board of Game has contributed to the extremism to which the Board of Game has gone slaughtering Alaska's wolves and now bears, ever more extreme. And even here on the Kenai Peninsula, they're planning to kill wolves, even though the state biologists acknowledge that it will not accomplish their goal since there's nothing for the moose to eat in the region they're planning on killing them in.
Well, it certainly has gotten worse since Gordon's death. And as Joel Bennett said, Gordon would be outraged. He would be even more outraged than he was when he was here. When they got rid of that buffer in 2010, the February after Gordon's death, they got rid of the partial buffer in the stampede area. That's when the wolf population really started plummeting and the viewing rates really started plummeting. And you're right, with the wolf and bear predator control going on in the state. You know, Gordon always went to the Board of Game meetings. He always stood up and he said his piece. The Board of Game always cut him off and never asked him any questions and dismissed him entirely. But he still went and he still said what he said. They still heard it. So maybe he was having an effect on them even then. But certainly the other thing is that without Gordon, we don't know so much of what's going on with Alaska's wolves. We really don't know what's happened to the Toklats. We really don't know what's going on with the Grant Creek family group or all the other. He studied 20-some different wolf family groups in the Denali area and the Yukon-Charlie 40-mile area. We do not know what's going on with those wolves anymore. All we have are numbers, and numbers are pretty meaningless.
We're going to go to a call from Johnny in Anchorage here in a moment, but first I'd like to take this break as Talk of Alaska continues. Thanks, John.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
We're talking about the wolf. Mary Beth Holloman is with us, and Johnny is on the phone from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mary Beth, Johnny.
Hi, how you doing?
Real good.
Good, thanks.
Hi, Mary Beth. I just wanted to, Gordon and I were friends for 43 years, so I could talk for days on Gordon Haber and various stories and things, but I wanted to thank you for spending the time that you did to compile all his research and put it into a readable form that I think many, many people that have an open mind will enjoy reading. I was going to ask you what difficulties you ran into over the two or three years you spent putting the book together, because that must have been quite a task to try to put together 43 years of research into one book.
Coffee stains, I think, were a problem.
Yeah, Gordon wasn't around, so I could ask him, where did you put that file, and what? How do these two things relate, and is this the same family group you're talking about here? It was extremely difficult, but it was also so enlightening. I mean, I spent days just pouring through his materials, and one of so many lasting impressions, boxfuls of those little write-in-the-rain pads, those little yellow write-in-the-rain pads that I use too as a writer, and going all the way back to 66 and just flipping through those, everything that he recorded. He recorded everything he saw. I mean, he was a true field biologist.
And later on, he started tweeting.
And then he started tweeting, right? In the last year of his life, he was tweeting too. He was truly full bore on trying to get this message out any way he could. Yeah, but there were challenges to it that I couldn't have imagined. The photographs alone were challenging because there were thousands upon thousands of them. But it was also quite enlightening and quite a joy to be able to do this. I mean, I just feel so fortunate that the family gave me access to all his materials to be able to put this book together.
And the collection is housed right at the library now?
Yes, all of Gordon's papers and photographs, all of his research materials are archived at the Arliss Library.
That's great. That's right down the street
right
from the
Woonsocket
Broadcast Center.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I just wanted again to thank you. Gordon would appreciate it. I appreciate it, and I'm sure the world will appreciate it because it's such an important piece of research. I just wanted to share one story.
Please, yes.
Mary Beth mentioned the storm and circle approach that a wolf pack or a family group had taken, and actually, back in 1970, I saw that myself. I went down to pick up Gordon. He was coming in with his pilot, and he told me he had the flu or something, and he was feeling ill. I kidded him about air sickness, which he denied, and he said, "Well, my pilot's going back out. If you'd like to go with him, because we're on a group of wolves." And so we went back out, and right there around the Savage River, we came across 16 wolves. This was in March, so they were coming over a ridge, and there was still a lot of snow. And down below the ridge was a cow moose with two calves. And the wolves saw the cow with calves, and the cow with calves saw the moose, and they were several hundred yards away. And the moose just stayed put, and you could see all the wolves circling around the leader. And then all of a sudden they decided, yeah, let's do it, and they charged down the hill. They surrounded and circled the moose, and we were close enough you could see them barking and growling and their mouths open as they tried to panic one of the calves. But the mother was too good, and after about 5 minutes of that, all the wolves went over and laid down about 10, 15 yards away, and the moose kind of relaxed, and then the wolves got up and started trotting off. And the message that I took from that was a broken jaw or a broken leg to a wolf is a death sentence. So they're very careful about what they kill, and they test a lot more than they actually kill. And I think a lot of people think that wolves go out and kill at random just about anything they want to. Anyway, I just wanted to pass that story along.
Thanks
so much, Johnny. Great story. Lucky you that you got to see that.
I know. It was a real highlight, as so many times spent with Gordon were. The other question I had was, have you, in your research or in your thinking, ever come up with a significant reason why there is, and always has been, such hatred and demonizing of wolves? Why in particular wolves?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I reviewed a book a long time ago called Vicious that was about the wolves in the lower 48 and the Pilgrims and the Mormons movement across the U.S. and settling the western states and their fear of wolves. And there was no record of anyone being attacked and eaten by a wolf. And it's really, it's complex. I think, we fear what we don't know. Two, we fear what we see as competition, a competing predator that is good at what they do. And so I think there's some jealousy involved on the part of people that hate them now, because wolves are, they know what they're doing out there, and they're real survivors. But it's complicated. It's a million-dollar question, really.
And I wonder, up here in Alaska, what drives the predator control policies, which seem to just go on and on and on in
Well,
one
I
area
think we can speculate
another.
Pretty easily about that, Johnny. I mean, a lot of that has to do with big game hunting and more meat for us, and
Right.
I mean, it's pretty well, all you have to do is go to a game board. You can watch that mentality in operation.
You know, and the way they use language, too, they talk about culling and take and yield. It's as if they're growing a crop of moose.
Yeah.
And the wolves are pests that they need to eradicate to harvest their crop of moose. But it's not a farm.
But we're not here to bash the game board because I don't want to get started. I already have started, but
we don't have enough time.
No, totally not. And Johnny, I want to get one more call in here.
They're not following science as they're required to by the Constitution and by law.
That's right.
Of course, we could have quite the debate. Maybe we will in a future show. Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you, Johnny.
Let's go to Diane, joins the program from Seward. Diane, you're on with Mary Beth Holloman.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, I have a question. There was a woman killed by wolves in Chignik several years ago, and I never heard how that came to be or what. I just heard that the woman was attacked by wolves and killed. I'll take my answer off the air, but if you have any information on how that scenario all played out, I'd sure be interested in that. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, thanks, and you're not the only one. What do you think, Mary Beth? And one thing that you brought up was that wolves that are fragmented in the family might take more risks when they're hunting.
Yes. And so that happened on the Alaska Peninsula where they had been doing intensive management, so they were killing a lot of wolves. In fact, that's where that horrible story of the state wolf biologist went in. They shot up all the adults from the plane, and they landed, and they walked over to the den, and they pulled out each of the pups and shot them in the head. So there was a lot of fragmentation in that area. And so and I don't know because I wasn't there, but one speculation is that when you fragment the wolf family group, they do take more risks, and they're going to go after prey that they don't usually go after. They don't know their territory. They don't know the prey hunting techniques.
I wouldn't advise being a small person and acting like prey is probably not a good idea.
Right, yeah. And, you know, my heart goes out to her family. I mean, what a horrible loss for them. What a tragic loss. And certainly we need to realize that living in Alaska that there are big animals around. There are a couple other things that are worrisome about that. And again, these are not proven because we didn't get the results of the autopsies. The state did go in there and kill a bunch of wolves after she was killed. We don't know if they got those very wolves or not because we didn't get the results of the autopsies. But there was also some concern that they might have been rabid for some reason, that the people in Chignik were...
Time.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. We're just speculating anyway.
Right. Okay.
Thank you so much, Mary Beth Holloman. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for coming back.
And thanks for the hard work you did on this.
Sure. Thanks. And, thanks for having me.
It's hard to know. We keep pushing this ball forward where it's really going to go.
Right. Well, we just need to keep learning and thinking and keeping our minds open.
Thanks to Lori Townsend. Thanks to Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
the newly restored Historic Anchorage Hotel. You can find out more about this boutique hotel in the heart of downtown at historicanchoragehotel.com.
Calling all Alaskan artists, Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.